to the Beyond Addiction Show with Josh King. This program is designed to help those who are affected by substance use. Whether you are using, trying to stop, or a loved one who wants to help, there are many effective resources, and together we'll explore them and bring you hope. Now, here is your host, Dr. Josh King.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the last episode of the first season of the Beyond Addiction Show. That's right, today is our last episode of season one. And today we're going to welcome David Sheff, who's the author of Beautiful Boy, which is his memoir about his son's struggles with substance use and the impact on David as a father. Beautiful Boy was also made into a major motion picture last year, starring Steve Carell and Timothée Chalamet. Honestly, it was amazing. I watched it last night. My wife and I watched it, and we were like blown away of just how amazing it was. And so we're going to talk to David about his story and what it was like to go through all of this with his son, Nick, and what it's been like to take that to the public and just have such a large stage to talk about substance use and ways to help people, and some of the research that he's found along the way about what actually works to help people change. So I'm really excited about that interview and looking forward to it. And as I said, today's our last episode of season one, and I wanted to reinforce a little bit of why we're doing this show. Because just yesterday, here at CMC, at the Center for Motivation and Change, we fielded a phone call where a caller told us that they were struggling with crystal meth and they had found a treatment program, and they went into this treatment program, and the treatment program just started charging them and charging to their insurance and actually double charged. They charged twice for every single thing that was going on. They charged twice. And what they effectively did in doing that was drain the insurance, all of the insurance benefits that this person had, until the person ran out of insurance, and then they kicked him out of treatment. And so this guy calls up and says, I'm like struggling with crystal meth. I thought I found treatment. They totally screwed me over. They took all of my insurance money, and now they kicked me out of the program because I didn't have any insurance to pay, and I don't know what to do. And we hear this kind of story all the time. We heard yesterday as well that from a psychiatrist who, within 5 minutes on the phone of talking about somebody who he had never actually seen, diagnosed that person. Now, that's just unethical to begin with. You can't diagnose somebody who is who you've never seen. Like, that's not an allowed thing. But also, let's just think about how poorly that person is being treated. If somebody walks in or it just talks over the phone and they say, yep, here's what you've got. How could you possibly know that? So that was yesterday. Over the last few months and years of doing this work, I've heard of sober companions. Sober companions are people who are supposed to come and help you stay sober, that they are sober themselves and their job is to come and help you out in the world, outside of therapists' offices, to help you stay sober. And sometimes these are people who have no formal training, and the only reason that they have this job is because they are in recovery themselves. They are often charging more than it would cost you to go see a licensed psychologist, a doctoral level psychologist who has specific training in substance use, and they're just taking people's money. And what are they taking the money to do? Often their job is to walk you to an AA group. AA groups, by the way, they're free. So they're taking $300, $400 for the hour to go take you to an AA group that is free, that you could go to on your own for free, and then sit with you there and then walk you home. And that's just money that people are spending out. We've heard of rehabs and treatment centers who say, yes, our main modality of treatment is AA. Well, AA is not a treatment, first of all, and AA says very clearly that they are not a treatment. They're not a treatment protocol. They're not evidence-based in that way. And that it's also, it's free. And these rehabs and treatment centers are taking thousands of dollars from people to give them something that they could get for free in their neighborhood. Often those rehabs are also saying that, oh yeah, we will do DBT, which is dialectical behavior therapy, or CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, or specific trauma treatments. But when you look a little bit closer, it turns out that there's no one on the staff who's ever been trained. No one has been certified. No one is supervising the work that they've done or that they're doing. There's no real way to know at all that they're actually doing what they say they're doing, because they don't have anybody who is able to watch it, because no one there knows the treatments. And we don't even have to go into the history of treatment programs that are woefully behind in their understanding and in their use of medications to help assist with the treatment of substance use disorders, because we've talked about it a million times on this show already. Those kinds of examples, just, they drive me crazy, because here at CMC and in the work that we do, we are working really, really hard to make sure that we are on top of all of the current treatments, on top of current trainings, making sure everyone is trained, making sure that we're following along with all of the right resources, the trainings, the supervisors, that we're keeping up on the information that is coming out. And then we hear these stories where people are saying, I went to what I thought was there, and it's just not there. The treatment, the evidence, none of it is there. And so they're getting subpar treatment and they're getting subpar service for moments when they need it the most. So we started this show to help you, the consumer, learn about treatments that are proven to be effective from people who are trained and are experts in them. We've talked to parents who have been through the process with their kids and are now advocates to change the system. And we did all of this so that you can be informed consumers of treatment. And that is the most important message. I was reading that the average car buyer spends about 15 hours researching before they decide to buy a car. 15 hours. Think about that. That's like a lot of time of spent on the web, looking at reviews for cars, thinking about the cost benefit, what it's going to be like, what you want, what you like from it, then going to dealers, test driving cars, asking more questions, talking to other people about it. 15 hours. Now, I don't know how long people actually spend trying to find the right treatment program, but I would be willing to bet that in the moment, it's not that much. And the reason that I'd be willing to bet that is because if you're looking for treatment and you're really scared, you're worried, you're being told by people that if you don't do this right now, they're going to die. If you don't do this right now, you are at severe risk of death. You're going to say, all right, well, sign me up. Because when I don't know what's going on, if I'm told this is do this or die, or this is the only way that you can do this, I'm going to jump at that. And that's what we've heard from parents on this show, and what we've heard from treatment providers who have said, yeah, we've done this research and this is what people are told. So your job as a consumer of mental health treatment is to take your time, to ask the right questions, and to know the facts. And I hope, truly, truly hope, that this show has helped listeners and anybody who is connected to this show feel more comfortable to do just that.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org. Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com, available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the 20MinuteGuide.com. That's 20MinuteGuide.com.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to Facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to Facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the show. It never fails that if you're going to have the last show and have a nice big guest, you're going to have a computer problem and the audio is going to cut out on you. So I'm going to jump right in and welcome to the show David Sheff. David Sheff is the author of Beautiful Boy, which is an amazing memoir about his struggles with his son's struggles with substance use and how that have impacted his family and himself. And it became a major motion picture starring Steve Carell and Timothée Chalamet. And it's just really amazing. And the work that he's been doing has been amazing. Welcome to the show, David Sheff.
Oh, thank you, Josh. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks for coming here. Thanks for dealing with all of the complicated technology issues. David, tell me a little bit about your story, yours and Nick's story, for those who don't know it.
Sure. The short version is that we are like and were like many families who, you know, are going forward in our lives without ever contemplating the idea that a child could become addicted. We have this image of what quote-unquote drug addicts look like, and they sure don't look like, you know, our kids. But indeed, my son, my oldest son, became addicted. He started using when he was about 11. His use escalated. Pretty soon he was shooting meth and heroin and on the streets, and we endured about 10 years of hell, and anybody who's been there knows what it's like. Earlier, you were talking about the broken treatment system, and we tried our best to navigate it. It was a nightmare, both making decisions about treatment, and then finally, when I would get Nick into treatment, it was appalling treatment. Looking back, I realized that he got almost no what we would consider real treatment. I mean, he never saw addiction psychiatrists or psychologists. He was subjected to programs that were offering things that, looking back, were, you know, they should be considered malpractice. I mean, Nick being punished for having this illness. Anyway, after 10 years, you know, he was finally doing better. He was sober for about a year and a half. I'm a journalist. I went forward to write about our experience. That led to Beautiful Boy. Nick wrote a memoir from his perspective called Tweak, and it really is what opened the door for us to the suffering out there, and we've since then connected to thousands and thousands of people who are, you know, their stories are very, very, very much like ours, and, you know, when oftentimes with this, you know, we suffer alone because of the shame involved, and, you know, we did until finally this door opened, and pretty soon we realized we aren't alone, and there's been this ongoing conversation that's been going on for 10 years, and, you know, and recently the movie based on our books came out, and it just, it continued and expanded the conversation because, you know, movies are just bigger. Hollywood, you know, this was an Amazon Studios movie, and the company really devoted themselves at the beginning to try to raise awareness of addiction. And so, you know, there's been a lot of conversation around the movie that has, you know, really, from what I've heard, has really, you know, helped people who are in the throes.
Yeah, the movie, and I want to get to the movie in a minute, was so amazing, and it really, you know, there's a reason why Timothy Chalamet is up for like every single award for this, because he does such an amazing job of portraying sort of the angst that, you know, somebody goes through when they're in the throes of substance use. It doesn't look fun. It doesn't look like he's having a good time.
To me, that was, so when I watched the movie, I thought, you know, there was a lot of it that was devastating to me to watch, to be reminded, to actually watch, to see, you know, stuff I knew about, you know, the intense drug use, the some of the dangerous situations Nick was in. But one of the brilliant pieces, as you say, is people have this idea that those who are addicted, those who are using drugs, are all they care about is wanting to get high. It's a, you know, they want to have fun zone out, whatever it is. And they don't care about anybody, and they're in sort of this blissful world. And, you know, I know from Nick's experience that this portrayal in the movie is incredibly important to me, because it shows us that as bad as this kid's use was, I mean, this extreme, extreme life-endangering drug use, he was not having fun. He was in pain, and you see it every shot of him. You know, even when the behavior externally looks like, you know, it's this unconscionable, you know, selfish, you know, drug use that, you know, is destroying his family, his parents, you know, his stepmom, me, hurting his little brother and sister immeasurably. Again, it looked like a choice. And I thought, oh, my God, what just happened to my child? I thought I knew him. Well, in this movie, you see that this is a kid who's in pain. And, of course, over the course of the film, he learns more about himself, just as Nick, you know, my son, learned more about himself. And over the course of 10 years of treatment, I talked about the bad treatment he got. Well, you know, he got some good treatment. He was diagnosed with co-occurring mental illnesses. He has bipolar disorder, depression. He's now working with a, you know, extraordinary addiction psychiatrist in Los Angeles, a doctor at UCLA. In addition to that, you know, he's on Suboxone, so he's on addiction medication. He finally got, you know, the treatment that one should get if they're sick, if they're ill. And since then, he's been fine. And so, you know, we're lucky that even though it took 10 years, he finally was diagnosed and finally is in treatment, and he's been sober now for 9 years, and I know how lucky we are, and I'm reminded of that every day when I open up my computer and I check my private messages on Twitter and, you know, Facebook, whatever, and I hear from so many people. I cannot tell you how many people who write to me to tell me that, you know, they're surviving the loss of a child, or they're trying to survive the loss of a child, or a husband or a wife or a parent, who brother or sister, whoever it is.
Yeah, we see the same thing here about how much pain there is and how many people are struggling, and it's so great to hear that Nick got the kind of treatment that he needs. And I want to be able to go into some of what that treatment is. But before we do that, you know, you mentioned the idea of the shame, the stigma of like wanting to hide all of this. What was it like for you to put all of this out in the world?
Well, it was at first, it was really scary. You know, I knew that there are some people that would judge Nick and judge us. I mean, I must be a terrible father if my son becomes addicted. You know, that's sort of a assumption I think that many people have and that I did, or at least I worried about. But, you know, lo and behold, what I found out is that when we tell our stories, you know, it's amazingly empowering. It was to me, and I think it was to Nick, and it was, I think, to so many other people. Again, you know, it started a conversation, and the very people who I thought would be the most judgmental, you know, people at our younger kids, Daisy and Jasper School, you know, there's some people that we didn't even know, and there was a very sort of sense of a conservative sort of community there. And I just didn't know. And, of course, what happened was, you know, people grabbed me and sort of pulled me around the corner, a mom who I didn't know but I'd seen for years, who just burst into tears and told me about growing up with an alcoholic father and how she was terrified because her eighth grader, she just found that he was smoking pot. I heard from parents. I heard from people who talked about problems that weren't necessarily addiction-related, but a child with an eating disorder, a brother or a sister who was, you know, missing because they had mental illness that had never been treated. And so, yes, fear that we were going to be exposing ourselves in such a way, but ultimately it felt valuable to me, which is why I went forward to do it, so people would know that, no, we're not alone. Again, this idea that we can give one another permission to be open and honest when we open ourselves, when we open our hearts. And that is not the solution to our problems, but it is a huge first step in healing because we can help one another, we can support one another, and, you know, go forward on this very, very challenging journey, not isolated, but in fact part of a community of people that are trying to figure out how to help their own, you know, addiction, their own illness, or the addiction of a loved one.
I'd like to play a small clip from the film that's actually about this idea, because it's the moment when Steve Carell playing you, had just left Nick early on in an early rehab, and you're getting in the car and talking to your wife and saying to her, like, please don't talk about it. I don't like that you're talking about this with so many other people. Let's listen to the clip, and then I'd like to hear your thoughts about that.
Dear Chef.
Hi, Mr. Chef. This is Eddie Goldblum from the Olaf Center.
Oh, yes. Hi. Hello.
I am sorry to disturb you, but I need to inform you about Nick.
Okay.
He left the facility today during free time, and he hasn't returned since. I'm sorry, Mr. Chef, but please don't despair. This happens.
But I thought you said he was doing so well.
You should think of this as part of the process. Relapse is a part of recovery.
Relapse is part of recovery?
Yeah, it's a part of Nick's learning process.
Well, that's like saying crashing is part of pilot training.
Look, he'll be back, and probably really quick.
Do you have somebody out looking for him?
It is not our responsibility once he leaves the facility.
Okay.
But he is welcome to...
David, were you able to hear the clip? Do you know the clip I'm talking about?
I was, and I can address it, you know, from the perspective that people, that, you know, I guess you're going to edit this, so maybe you won't even say that you're going to...
play the clip,
but just
live.
Say, you know, you can just ask the question that you did, and if you can figure out how to pop it in there, yeah, I'll address it. I think that this is the most difficult disease out there. It's not the most difficult in terms of prognosis because there are many, many, many serious illnesses that, you know, in some cases have even worse prognosis. Treatment is harder. Treatment is less likely. but it's the only one that looks like a choice. It does not look like someone is getting cancer from just randomly or another many other diseases. It looks like someone has made a choice because, of course, no one forced my son to go out and score methamphetamine or heroin. So in that way, you know, it was a choice. But what we know, and what it took me a long time to learn, is that people who are addicted are no longer in the frame of mind where they can make that choice because this is a brain disease. Their brains are not functioning properly. It's like someone with schizophrenia and expecting them, you know, being surprised when they don't follow, you know, a doctor's instructions or don't take their medication. You know, it's the very, you know, part of us, our ability to, you know, our cognitive abilities that are impacted here. And so, you know, it looks like these people are making a choice and one that is immoral, appalling. And so, you know, we do keep it a secret. I did not want people to know that Nick was a drug addict. Again, I'm using that word because that is the word that people on the outside would use. And, you know, there are stories, I hear them all the time, of people who lose their jobs because they become addicted, because they have a disease, people who are shunned in their communities because they have a disease, kids in school who, you know, who end up being kicked out because they have a disease. So, you know, until I learned, first of all, I guess until things got so bad that I couldn't hide it anymore. I mean, we were just trying to survive every single day. But also, you know, when I realized that I was not alone, that many of us were suffering, and that when we were open about our suffering, we were able to, as I sort of said before, you know, we were able to support one another, and the pain was less because the isolation was less. It did not mean that I was not freaked out 24 hours a day, but that additional component of the experience of being, you know, having someone you love addicted, at least that part was gone. I could go out with somebody. I went to, Daisy and Jasper were a lot younger, and they were on a swim team, and I remember going to a swim team event, and Nick was out. I didn't know where he was. He was on the street somewhere, and I didn't know if he was alive or dead, and you know, I'm sitting on the sidelines with all these other parents, and they're cheering their children along, and I didn't want them to know, and so I was hiding it, just like, you know, Steve Carell, you know, me, in the movie,
I was in pure
hell, pretending that everything was okay, cheering the kids, you know, and their swim meet, and in the meantime, you know, realizing that the next phone call I got could have been the one that every parent is terrified of, you know, that my son hadn't made it.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very powerful scene in the movie where you're walking with the kids and it was a swim meet that your son Jasper had, you know, talked to Nick about, and he said that he was going to come and show up there, and then he's not, and he says, like, is Nick on drugs again? And you couldn't, Steve Carell, like, couldn't even respond, and it's just not responding, and you know, your wife had to say, we don't know, and yeah. Just say that to a little kid. I mean, that was really, I mean, there were a lot of tears shed last night watching this movie. I won't lie. It was a super emotional thing to watch, but I that's what people go through every day.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, that is part of the power, again, of telling our stories. And when it's told in a movie or whether it's told in a book or when people are even sharing their own stories with one another, they're, you know, we don't want to see it. We don't want to feel it. It is painful, but this is painful. It's painful when someone you love is sick, and I feel like we have to face it if ever we're going to address it. And you raised the conversation between, you know, mom and dad, me and, you know, really was very realistic, my wife and I, with Daisy and Jack, our littler kids. And that raises a whole other issue, which is the devastation of addiction, not only on the person who is ill, but on the family. Again, if my son had any other disease, it would be horrible. It'd be hell. We would be terrified. But the hurt is different, or the fear is different. The fear, of course, is that the illness is not going to get well. It's going to take our loved one away from us. But in the meantime, we aren't having to question the behavior. And so when their older brother, who they worshipped, they were just, you know, best friends. When he started doing things that, you know, didn't make any sense, that were unconscionable, he would disappear. His little brother and sister were so worried, they didn't understand what was going on, but also they saw their mom and dad, Karen, me, beside ourselves, not sleeping. I was, you know, chasing him in the middle of the night. I was calling the sheriff, going down to the emergency room. I mean, it was for years and years and years. And the reality is that everyone in our family was traumatized by that experience, including Nick, of course, but all of us. And I think
I'm sure.
A really, really important message for people to understand, too, which is, first of all, to acknowledge just how traumatic it is to watch somebody that you love come close to dying many, many times. On this road that really is appalling and also just is so hard to fathom. But the flip side of that is that once we know the impact on families, we realize that we don't only have to treat the person who's ill, but we really have to face the fact that, you know, our families are suffering, and so families need to be part of treatment. For us, that meant finally getting the family therapist, who was an addiction doctor, to acknowledge. We finally went to see one, the four of us. You know, Nick was gone again, so we didn't know where he was, but Karen and I recognized that Daisy and Jasper were suffering. And this addiction doctor, this family therapist, we sat there with him, and the first thing he said to them was, he acknowledged what they've been fearing and feeling, which is, you know, how scary it is to have someone you love addicted, how much it doesn't make sense. And he said, and I want to teach you a word that you may not have heard, and the word is ambivalence. And it means that you can feel two things at the same time, so that you can love your brother and miss him and worry about him, but also be really mad at him, maybe even hate him, maybe even be afraid of him. And over the course of that first session, you could just see in their bodies, you know, Daisy and Jasper sort of relax and open up to the fact that here was somebody acknowledging what they were feeling. And it was a huge step forward, and we continued to go to family therapy for a long time, and it was, it was so helpful. I don't know what would have happened if we hadn't done that.
That's great. And, you know, one of the things that I'm hearing is a regular theme, and I want to switch into sort of the research that you've done and the effective treatment that you've found. But one of the things that I keep hearing is that you stayed connected in so many ways, and that's not always the recommendation. You really did. You really stayed connected. So what?
Yeah, one of the things that just really, you talked earlier about people who are getting bad treatment, and they're getting treatment that really is, you know, qualifies, as I said before, as malpractice, because we are paying money, whether it's out of our own pockets or whether it's insurance or whether it's some, time it's county-run programs, whatever it is. And people are not being treated. So we watch this disease escalate, and in the meantime, we're being told. Well, I guess what I was going to say is, you talked about how that enrages you, and it enrages me now to look back and see how many people told me throughout this process that I had to stand back, you know, wash my hands of my son. Let him sink to the lowest possible place. You know, the words over and over again, of course, are hitting bottom. If I tried to help him, I was enabling him. I had to practice tough love, and I tried. And sometimes I did it, actually, and I look back and just realize that we are lucky. And I realize that because when I hear from people or meet them, you know, when I go out and I'm on the road and I'm meeting people who are affected, you know, devastated by addiction in their families, and they tell me that they did what the counselors told them, or they were told by other parents or by other so-called experts. They practiced tough love. They hung up the phone. They shut the door. They shunned the person that they love. And the next call they got was that their loved one had died. So I went deeper into that idea, and, you know, it makes no sense. But also, the research disproves that as a concept. You know, we don't want somebody who's sick to get worse. We don't want them to hit bottom. We want to hold them up. because, first of all, the debilitation is worse. Second of all, of course, it's less likely that they're going to die. I mean, that's the main one, I guess. But also, it's easier to treat someone the earlier we intervene. And so, you know, one of the doctors, the addiction doctors I work with and I've been taught by, says, you know, waiting for an addict, for somebody with addiction to hit bottom is like waiting for somebody with diabetes to get worse to the point that you have to amputate their leg. It makes no sense. And yet, we are told it over and over again. And so talk about things that enrage us. I mean, that enrages me. When people ask me, you know, what to do, because they are being told that, I say, go do what you can to help a person that you love. You don't want to enable them. You don't want to give somebody money because they probably could kill them quicker because, you know, as a cliche, you know, giving money to somebody who's addicted and active use, you know, is like giving somebody who's suicidal a gun. But that does not mean cutting them off. It does not mean standing back. It does not mean withholding your love. A dad wrote me and he said, you know, I practiced tough love because I was told to do it. My son died. You know, was my love tough enough?
Oh, that like strikes right through my heart. I mean, to hear something like that, it's just so hard. We've been advocating for a long time, you know, let's get rid of that concept because it's dangerous. And it's not backed up by evidence at all.
Yeah. So, yeah, and it's also something that is so counterintuitive that I think is really appalling, too, is that it's not that it isn't hard enough when you have somebody that you love in trouble, you know, on a course that could kill them, but you're being told that what you're feeling is bad, is wrong, is dangerous, is going to hurt them. You know, what is it to be a parent more than wanting to save the life of a child? That's bad? That's a wrong impulse? Of course it's not. No, a parent does what that impulse is there because that's what our job is. That's what we're programmed to do. That's our primal motivation in life. And so we need to be encouraged to do that rather than discouraged. And we need to be helped to do it because it's not easy.
No, absolutely. So what tips do you have for families right now that you could put out there as a dad who's been through this, who has come out the other side, but who's also done a ton of research? What would you say to people that they could and should be doing now?
Well, the first thing is, I guess the first two things. One of them is what we were just talking about. Don't give up. Don't stand back. You know, acknowledge the fact that you have somebody in your family who is ill, and you want to do everything you can to help them. And the only sort of parallel piece of advice there is to recognize that this is really, really hard and it's really stressful. And you have to protect yourself. You have to protect the rest of your family, you know, younger children in our case. And that involves, you know, getting help for ourselves, as I said, you know, therapy, whatever. You might try different kinds of therapy. You know, for us, we met with a few different family therapists until we found somebody who really seemed to connect and to understand what we were going through. So those are sort of the two essentials. And then it gets more complicated because how do you find treatment in a world in which there are so many charlatans? You know, in many cases, in some cases, they're, you know, people and companies that are really trying to rip people off. But most cases, I don't think that's true. Most people who are in the treatment world are trying to do the best they can, and they're completely well-meaning, but they just don't know what they're doing because they've never been trained. You know, when Nick went to programs where he was punished because he was late to a meeting or he skipped a group session, you know, one time he was set outside in the cold weather with a pair of scissors and told to cut the grass. I mean, that's not treatment for a disease. So what we want to do is find programs that are run by qualified people, which means people who have been trained in addiction medicine, people who have credentials. We want a person who is in serious trouble because of being addicted to get psychologically tested, because so often people who get severely addicted also have, besides a substance use disorder, they also have a co-occurring mental illness. In Nick's case, bipolar disorder and depression. If you're going yourself or sending someone to a program that doesn't include that kind of testing, working with a psychiatrist, you can get someone sober over and over again, and suddenly they are no longer high. They're not treating their drugs, or at least trying to treat their mental illness with drugs. In Nick's case, he would get off methamphetamine, be released from treatment, and then all of a sudden that craziness that came with his bipolar disorder or that deep, dark depression would hit. And it wasn't surprising that he went back to the only way that he knew to get some relief at all, and that was to return to drugs. So, you know, it's hard to navigate the system, but I think the thinking behind it is to do what we would do if somebody had another illness. What do? We don't go to a church basement to talk about it. We don't look online and, you know, go to a program for somebody with cancer where the modality, you know, is something that makes no sense. You know, in the old days, for a while, it was treating people with cancer with, you know, it's called Laetril, something that came from the pits of peaches or apricots. I mean, not logical. What we want to do is we want to get the best doctor we can. So we want to make inquiries, get assessment by a professional who's a treatment addiction specialist. We can find them, as hard as it is to find them, we can find them on the directories of the American Association for Addiction Medicine or the American Association of Addiction Psychiatrists. We find programs that luckily do exist. You know, the Center for, I don't know if it's supposed to be, you know, a time to plug CMC, and I'm not doing it because, you know, I'm talking to an organization that is involved with CMC, but I'm doing it because it is a program that is founded on science, and it is run by people who've been trained in addiction medicine, and the treatments that are offered include work with a psychiatrist when that's appropriate, addiction medications when they are appropriate, and many programs out there. There was just a survey that showed that about two-thirds of all programs that are available don't allow people with addiction to be on medications that could save their lives. I mean, that is appalling. And then all the behavioral treatments that have been proven to work. So we need to rely on science, on medical science, not tradition, not best guesses, not the prejudices of people who finally got sober because they tried something that worked for them. You know, it's having cancer does not qualify someone to treat cancer. So, you know,
hey,
strap on your seatbelt. It's not easy. Have support. Don't give up. And try to find the best treatment grounded in science, grounded in addiction medicine that you can.
Well, thank you so much for the plug. I mean, it is really, everything that you said has been echoed on the previous shows, and I'm so glad to hear you say it, and I think you have just had this great voice in the community, and thank you so much for coming on the show and withstanding all of the technical difficulties that we've had today. You have a new book that's coming out that you wrote with Nick.
Yes, and what we determined over the years that, okay, when we have a disease, we want to do two things. We want to treat the disease. But, of course, if we can prevent a disease, then we prevent, the cost associated with someone being sick, the attempts to treat the disease, in some cases, the inability to treat the disease. So we want to prevent any illness if we can. Nick and I then face this question, you know, can we treat a addiction? And the answer is yes. It's hard, but it is possible, and there are a lot of ways to do that, and I was just talking about some of those. But then the question is, can we prevent this disease? Well, it could appear that we can't because we've been so bad doing it. We've been trying for decades to prevent kids from using. We know that we want to focus on young people because most addictions, 90% of people who become addicted started using drugs when they were teenagers. So then the question is, can we prevent teenagers? And we know what we've done in the past has not worked. We've lectured kids. We've told them to just say no. We've tried to scare them. So what we identified was the fact that we needed to reach people at a very young age and give them real information, not exaggerations, teach them about the ways that brains work, teach them about their own brains so that they understand that they're in a time of their lives when their brains are developing, and give them strategies and skills to navigate those years to help them learn how to get through the weekend when everybody else that they know is out getting high. You know, is it possible for kids to do that? Well, yeah, it is, but they need to be helped. We can't just tell them and lecture them and say you're going to get in trouble if you try drugs. Instead, we want to give them strategies. And the other thing we did is we realized that so many kids use drugs not because it's fun or not even because of peer pressure, but as a way to get through their days and nights that are really stressful. So some kids are dealing with stresses at home. Some kids are dealing with stresses at school. Kids are being, you know, bullied. They're being cyber-bullied. They're dealing with dysfunction in their families. They're dealing with violence in their neighborhoods or in their homes. So one of the things we spent a lot of time doing in this book that we wrote was helping kids reflect on their own lives and trying to recognize, are they experiencing anxiety, experiencing depression? We give them some actual tests that they can self-test so they can look at their experience and see what's going on. And then the big, big, big message throughout the book is ask for help. Get help. Help is out there. And so, yeah, so we came out this book. It's called High, and it is focused on kids, hopefully before they're using or at the very early stages of using when kids are in middle school. The book is circulating now. We're hearing from a lot of kids who are exactly in the kinds of situations that I've described. You know, they have this feeling that everyone I know is using drugs. You know, they don't want to or they're afraid to, but, you know, they're confused. And so we try to arm them in the best ways that we can. Yes, that's sort of the way that we're trying to talk to kids. Our hope, of course, is that it's not just us trying to talk to them, but we're hopefully trying to educate parents as well, schools, counselors. And, sometimes it can feel overwhelming, you know, and we realize that 200 people are dying every single day of this disease. But, you know, there are ways to treat this disease. There are ways to prevent it. So I have to, leave with some hope that we can turn the tide. It takes conversations like this, which is why it's so awesome what you're doing in these conversations.
Well, thank you very much. And really, it's amazing what you're doing. David, thank you so much for joining me. The book is called I. The other book, I mean, there's like so many books. It's called Beautiful Boy and Tweak by your son Nick. And, of course, the movie Beautiful Boy, which is available now. You can rent it on Amazon, and I recommend everyone do it. Nick, David, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
All right. Thanks, Ash. It was great to talk to you. Take care. Bye-bye.
That was great, and you know, thank you for anybody who survived through all of that technical difficulties. But I'm so happy that I'm able to offer a platform like this to people like David, who is doing such amazing work and really putting amazing things out there into the world. And since this is the last episode of the season, I just wanted to say a couple of thank yous. And first, I'd like to thank everyone who's listening, because without you, the program, right, it's not worth anything. This is for you, and I hope that it has been helpful for everyone who is listening. I'd also like to thank my family, specifically my wife, for putting up with all of my anxiety about the show and helping me support me through this, and my kids, Molly and Edie, who have listened to almost every show live, and my mom, who also listens and then calls and texts after each show to give me very honest reviews. I love them all, and I couldn't have done any of this without them. I'd like to thank also everyone here at CMC who has helped me come up with ideas, who sat with me to listen to intro music options and to put together the whole show, and who've supported me in this process. You're all the best clinicians and the best people that I know. And I'd especially like to thank Carrie Wilkins, who is one of the co-founders here at CMC and who has been a friend and a mentor throughout this process, but also throughout my entire career. And I really appreciate her. I'd like to thank all the guests who've come onto the show this season. They've been
taken their time out of their lives to come on here and share their information, but also they've made this their life. Their life is about helping people with substance use. And so thank you to all of them. And of course, the Voice America team, thank you for taking a chance on me and for taking care of this show. My producer, Josh, who did extra work today, my executive producer, Winston, thank you both. And really, I appreciate everyone who's taken the time to listen and be a part of this show. It's so meaningful to me, and people always, the feedback I always get is like, wow, your passion really comes through. And I am very passionate about this because we need more information like this out in the world. And so I am happy to be doing this. I want to share that passion. I want to push an agenda that says we need better treatment out there for people who are struggling with substance use. And I look forward to season two. We're going to take a couple of weeks off to regather our thoughts and put together a lineup for the next season. But I am looking forward to doing it again. So thank you everyone for being part of this show. And until next time, I'm Dr. Josh King, and this is the Beyond Addiction Show.
Thank you for joining us this week for the Beyond Addiction Show. Join us again next Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until the next program, we wish you encouragement and hope.